one of the things that happens to men that go with their partners to the abortion clinic, how guys are wired. One thing is we're wired to provide and protect for our partner and for our child. Mm-hmm. When a man sits there in the abortion clinic and their partner goes into the surgery room, the trauma happens at that moment because the fight or flight response within a male is inhibited. In other words, everything that God created me at that moment is to get up from my chair to protect my partner from getting hurt and protect my child from getting hurt. At that very moment, major trauma happened to me because how God wired me to get up there and say, stop, you're not going to hurt my partner, you're not going to hurt my child. I couldn't do that.
Welcome to the Empowered Manhood Podcast, where men rediscover courageous masculinity. Pull up a chair as we gain strength from the stories of God working in the lives of ordinary men today. These men have discovered that in a world of superficiality and isolation, we need authentic brotherhood to gain strength for the battles we face every day. Brought to you by the ministry of CLC, which challenges men to an uncommon pursuit of Christ, welcome to Empowered Manhood. Hey guys, welcome back to the Empowered Manhood Podcast, where we're helping men rediscover courageous masculinity in the light of the gospel. My name is Mike Hatch, and I serve as the National Relationship Generator for CLC. And I am joined, as usual, with my co-host, Chris Bollinger, who is an author and speaker, author of the best-selling men's devotional, Daily Strength for Men. Today, we're dealing with a fairly sensitive topic with regards to the trauma that a man experiences through his spouse or significant other having an abortion. And today we are joined by Gregory Hasek, who is a licensed mental health counselor in Florida and a licensed professional counselor in Oregon. And he works with the Southwest Florida Christian Counseling Ministry in Southwest Florida, near Naples, actually. And Greg specializes in working with men who are struggling with trauma from a previous abortion. So in this episode, you'll get to hear Greg's personal story and his own experience with this struggle himself, and how this led him to focus his own practice on this specific issue. And then Greg helps us to understand how a man's brain uniquely is affected by this specific type of trauma. Lastly, we talk about how men can approach counseling in general, which for many guys we know can be intimidating, honestly. Odds are, even if you haven't experienced this specific trauma yourself, you know another man who has. So we knew that we had to get Greg on the show to talk about this because most men just do not talk about this. So this was going to be a very valuable conversation, and I think will be really encouraging and equipping for those men who have either experienced this struggle themselves or who know someone who has. So without further ado, here is our interview with Greg Hasek. Greg Hasek, welcome to the Empowered Manhood Podcast, man. We're pumped to have you here.
Great to be here today.
Yeah, thank you. Definitely. So I'm really intrigued in getting into this subject. And I hope those guys who've been, you know, I don't know where they are. They could be, you know, some guys mow the grass as they listen to podcasts. Some guys are driving in their car, traveling different places. Some guys are doing the dishes like I do, you know, and do the dishes and listen to the podcast. Wherever these guys are, it's just interesting to think about them because I would think that they may have looked at this subject and it would have been really interesting because most guys, at least me specifically, I've said this even before we start recording, I don't think of men when it comes to abortions. I think of the women. And so, and chances are either a guy may have clicked on this thinking, well, that's interesting. I've never thought about that either. But I think there are some men who are listening today who may think back to their past and have experienced a trauma through abortion themselves. So this is very, this is going to be, I think, really relevant. I think guys are going to absolutely learn a ton from this and from you. And so I'm excited to get into this conversation. But before we jump in, Greg, as we do with every other guest, we ask them to share their fence post story. So, and for those of you who are listening for the first time, a fence post story just means every, you know, think of a fence along a property, and every vertical fence post represents a significant moment in your life or a person in your life that has influenced who you are today. And so, Greg, we'd love to hear a little bit more about who you are, a little bit more about your fence post story. So we can have some context around this.
Yeah, that's a great way to start, Mike. Tell you a little bit about my background. My mother was probably one of the most wonderful counselors without a degree growing up that I had ever experienced with someone. She was a wonderful example for me. She knew no strangers. She would give her last penny to someone. She had me in a nursing home at 5 years old, volunteering.
That's great.
So at a young age, she and my grandfather really were those people that got me started into the idea of how to help others and having a heart for people that are wounded. And, you know, here I am 5 years old learning how to care for people in a nursing home. And so my whole life has been in the kind of the caring field, and I just owe it to them for that kind of original root for where I got the heart for people.
And were they believers?
Yes, my mom and my grandfather were very strong believers. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So. With amazing servant hearts.
Exactly. That's
incredible. So that obviously laid a strong foundation for your faith, which I'm sure you never strayed from, right? You never, right? Did that?
Yeah. The good old college days, huh?
That's funny. Everybody goes to the college days when it comes to that. What? Anyway.
No, it was a blessing. And then, of course, growing up in youth group and things like that my whole life, and then going to a Christian college, and then ended up into school for a seminary, and then eventually got my degree in counseling. So it's been a kind of an amazing journey that way.
Wow. Did you have any thoughts of being a pastor?
Well, I never went that direction, really. I mean, you know, I always saw that, you know, pastors and counselors are a lot alike in some ways. They both have a heart for people, and they just kind of, it's a different focus area, that's all.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So what, was there anything early on for you that you can kind of point back to and say, boy, that experience really, really, I don't know, how do I say this, kind of was a seed to getting into the specific ministry you are in now, where you really do specialize in men who have suffered from trauma from abortion.
Yeah. First, I want to say, Mike, I really appreciate you addressing this issue to the audience. Just by saying that we can talk about men and abortion, we're validating the millions of men out there that are not validated for the pain of abortion. Our culture, our society makes it a non-male issue. They tend to focus it on as a female issue. That invalidation causes so much pain for men throughout the country. And just by you bringing this topic to the table today, I think is huge. So as far as kind of how I got into the work, so back in the mid-80s, I went through an abortion experience myself with a girlfriend at the time. I accompanied her to the abortion clinic. That was very traumatic for me. And I spent 5 years, Mike, looking for help, and I could not find help as a man. I went to crisis pregnancy center after crisis pregnancy center, and I basically had the door shut in my face, saying that we don't have services for men, we only treat women. It was after 5 years of getting into drinking, into kind of illicit behavior in terms of sexual behavior, and then eventually finding a crisis pregnancy center in North Carolina where they were able to take me in. They were all women's group. It was a recovery group. They were the first time they ever let a male into their group.
Wow.
And that was the beginning of my healing journey. And that was in the mid 80s. And so when I later got my degree in counseling in the mid 90s, I got my degree in 1998. I still had it in my heart. If I had such a hard time as a man finding help, there must have been millions of men out there like me that also couldn't find help. That seed was planted in my heart. And once I got my degree, God started kind of working on my heart and saying, okay, Greg, this might be something that's like a calling on your life. And that began kind of my journey of specializing in men and abortion.
Greg, are there estimates of how many men, I mean, we talk about millions, but are there estimates of the percentage of men who have experienced an abortion in the U.S.? Is it, you know, 1 in 5, 1 in 4? What are the estimates on that?
Yeah, so if we look at about 1 in 4 women by the age of, say, 45 have had an abortion, we know that there's a male for every woman that's had an abortion, right? Okay. So we can kind of look at those estimates and say, okay, on average, you're looking at, you know, about 1 in 4, probably at the same. So about 2004, I called around the country, around to people that had addressed men and abortion, and I brought those people together in 2004. We had the first ever men's summit on abortion in 2004. That was kind of the beginning of addressing men and abortion. And we formed a group called Men and Abortion Network in 2005. We had international conferences on men and abortion in 2007, 2008. And ever since then, I've been kind of specializing in that. To kind of answer the question of, like, how does a man present in counseling with men and abortion? I started specializing in sexual addiction around 2005, 2006. I started writing on my intake form, have you had an abortion in your experience in your past? And I started kind of looking at the number of men that presented for sexual addiction that actually had answered that question on my intake form, had they had an abortion in their past. What I was finding was about 1 in 3 of the guys that were coming for sexual addiction also had an abortion in their past. So I started kind of making those correlations and I started thinking, okay, if a man has had an abortion in his past and he hasn't dealt with it, maybe that's a possible trauma that's behind the presenting problem of sexual addiction. And they're not addressing that trauma that's underneath their behavior.
Hmm. I'm curious, Greg, and I want to talk about other men too, but I just kind of hearing a little bit more about your story. Can you share for us your personal experience when you went through it yourself, what that was like for you, and how did you eventually get to a place where you were like, wow, there's trauma there. I'm just curious for you specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that happens to men that go with their partners to the abortion clinic, how guys are wired. One thing is we're wired to provide and protect for our partner and for our child. Mm-hmm. When a man sits there in the abortion clinic and their partner goes into the surgery room, the trauma happens at that moment because the fight or flight response within a male is inhibited. In other words, everything that God created me at that moment is to get up from my chair to protect my partner from getting hurt and protect my child from getting hurt. At that very moment, major trauma happened to me because how God wired me to get up there and say, stop, you're not going to hurt my partner, you're not going to hurt my child. I couldn't do that.
Right.
And so I couldn't act on my natural fight response, which is part of trauma, fight or flight.
Right.
Now, my partner couldn't act on her flight response, which was she needed to get out of there and not let that happen to her body.
Hmm.
So So now my girlfriend is walking out of that clinic, stuck, unable to act on her flight. I'm stuck, unable to act on my fight. So we're two people traumatized walking out of the abortion clinic, and how God wired both of us is we went against our whole nature of how God wired both of us. And that damage that happens because of that is so deep.
Yeah.
And that was part of my journey of, like, I had to heal from how God wired me. I couldn't act on. And what does that do to a person?
Yeah.
Right.
Does that, yeah, totally. Did that, as you guys left, would you have been able, I'm curious about how it presented itself in that moment. Not that to get too detailed, maybe if whatever you're comfortable with sharing, of course, is or appropriate, but just, was it something that you were even cognizant of that time? In that moment, as you're walking out of the abortion clinic with her, you know, was she upset? Were you upset? Was it like, well, here we go, you know, kind of like whatever, moving on? Was it more like that? I'm curious.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Mike. When you look at that, you look at trauma in general, you look at the way the brain operates for both trauma and addiction. The right brain, when the right brain's under a state of trauma, it wants relief from that trauma. So the left brain goes offline. So in other words, when a person's in a crisis pregnancy and the man or woman are in that situation, they're not rationally thinking. They're acting on their part of their brain that's a fight or flight, which is irrational. So it's the right brain. Now, if a person has previous trauma, the male or female, they're more likely to act on that part of their brain that says you need to find a solution quick and you need to find relief, because it's a trauma response. What happens after it, just like with addiction, what happens after is the left brain comes back on. As soon as you are walking out of that abortion clinic, what did I do? What happened? Yep. How could I have let this happen? So now the right brain's off and the reality of everything hits. And so now you start to feel all the effect of your decision. And I went right into caretaking mode for my girlfriend. That's all I could, I felt like I could do.
Was right.
Care for her after the procedure. And what we know is most relationships end after abortion.
Yeah.
And so my relationship eventually ended.
And was she upset after that? Was she, or was it kind of similar that she was like, okay, relieved that this is over?
I think we both kind of experienced similar feelings. It was kind of a mutual decision at the time. But I think the maternal nature in her, it was very painful to watch that. You know, I mean, my paternal nature and her maternal nature, you know, obviously they're wired differently, you know, but the inability to care for that child that was in her. And Chris, you were saying something, I believe, about how, you know, people, when we talk about abortion, men don't seem to kind of come to the topic or the issue very often in terms of it being a men's issue. Males don't connect with the abortion word because they do perceive the abortion word as the female's body. They perceive the abortion word as the procedure that a female goes through. They don't perceive it as how a male would perceive the loss of a child. So when you say a man has lost a child, a man has lost his fatherhood lost, the loss of the role of being a dad, the loss of that child and the things that you could have done with that child. Now you're connecting with how a man is wired. That's why when we started doing work on men and abortion, we started saying fatherhood lost for men versus the abortion word, because men were not connecting with the abortion word.
So I'm guessing, Greg, that... and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you're the logical side of your brain kicks in. You went to trying to care for your girlfriend. I'm guessing that you kind of buried your own feelings and your own processing of what you had gone through. And I think guys get pretty good at this, right? I mean, we get good at burying stuff. So then it started emerging in other parts of your life, and you eventually made the connection. You recognized that this probably stemmed from the abortion. Guys tend to make that connection eventually, or do they just keep it buried?
That's a very good question. You know, so for example, when a guy comes into counseling for sex addiction, they rarely ever make those connections.
Okay.
They rarely make a connection from their presenting problem of sexual addiction to any past trauma, abortion being one of them, whether it's past sexual abuse, physical abuse as a child, a past abortion. But once they start to kind of get sober from that addiction, once they start to stop medicating their pain, or he can start feeling his feelings. You see, when a guy's medicating his feelings or medicating his pain, he doesn't feel. He's like, no. Okay, right. Once he's sober long enough, he can begin to look at what are some of those things underneath the addiction, and where did those past traumas start, and how did they affect his presenting behavior? And then to make those correlations, to make those ties back to those past traumas, abortion being one of them, is often it's very powerful for that guy to do that. For example, let's say a guy presents with an affair, and he can't attach to his spouse, he can't attach to his affair partner, and he has a problem with attachment. Once he realizes, okay, maybe the problem of attachment is related to not being able to attach to the lost child that they would have had. Mm-hmm. Once they start to make, where did that break of being able to attach start? Was it your childhood? Mm-hmm. Was it some other trauma? Was it the loss of a child that you didn't attach to? And now you can't attach to your spouse? And now you're having an affair? And so you can start to make those correlations of, we got a problem of attachment. We have a problem of a past trauma, and that's affecting your ability in terms of your current relationship even.
Thank you for sharing that, Greg. Right. Just getting to know that you've been down that road and you've got a heart for this. Obviously that must really, I think God is got to be using you in some pretty effective ways in men's lives. So just grateful for that. And so maybe it might be a good time to back out for a view from 1,000 feet, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Chris, you had some stats in terms of how many men are dealing with this.
Right.
And it was really fascinating.
Yeah. I've been to counseling, both marital counseling and individual counseling. And found it very beneficial, but I think back to the first time that my first wife suggested that we go to counseling. And I remember that there was no way I was going to go. You know, this is early in my first marriage. And I just thought that it was a sign of weakness. You know, I, if we've got issues, let's solve the issues. You know, we can do this on our own. And so I guess I wasn't terribly surprised when I read that 80% of the people who seek counseling are female. And then before we started recording, Greg, you had a funny comment about how the other 20% are men who are being dragged there by their wives. And so, I mean, we can look at a lot of stats. I mean, I found some stats on, we already talked about, you know, the percentage of men that have been affected by abortion, and I have some stats on other trauma in men, but I guess I'm curious why guys tend to act like I did early in my first marriage, which is, I don't need no stinking counseling. I mean, I'm assuming that if a man goes, you know, we talk about PTSD, and if a man goes through, you know, something that we would classify as PTSD, then he's probably not reluctant to get help for that. But why don't we treat other types of trauma like abortion, like sexual abuse in childhood? Why don't men perceive those as trauma worthy of going and getting some help?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Chris. And there's several components that I can address. One is, if you start back to when young boys are growing up, their gender conditioning is, here's what a male's role model is in terms of gender conditioning. Men, you know, boys don't cry. You need to be tough. You need to be kind of a leader. And some, of course, not learning to ask for help kind of can sometimes be part of it. And then you enter into a culture that says male trauma is not valid. You should be tough. You shouldn't seek help, especially when you think about military people and things like that. And so now you've got gender conditioning, cultural conditioning, all going against the male in terms of him seeking help. Okay. And then you have a culture that invalidates male trauma in general and perceives men as perpetrators of female trauma and not victims of trauma. Now, think about that. If you think about the sex abuse issue, you think about the abortion issue, you think about the domestic violence issue, any of these types of issues, men are perceived as perpetrators of female trauma in our culture. Now, ever since the 1970s, there was a shift in both the perception of males and the legal system in terms of men's rights. Men lost their right to choose abortion. If a woman wants to choose abortion without a male's consent, they can do that. Men lost a lot of different rights in terms of, you know, the divorce kinds of stuff. And so what happened is there was a big shift in how men were perceived as perpetrators versus, you know, victims of trauma. And we're still stuck in that frame. And so where on TV or where in media do you see men perceived as hurting versus perceived as aggressors? Mm-hmm. And it's sad. Because of that, men are trapped and they won't seek help, because if everybody sees them as the problem versus hurting, guess what happens? Mm-hmm. Their symptoms come out in addictions, in abuse, in aggression, because nobody is getting help because they're not validated. So then what happens is it creates this terrible cycle of men are again perceived as perpetrators because they have unresolved trauma.
Yep. Are you familiar with Jason Wilson? He's a Black author. He in Detroit, and he runs a, I can't remember what the type of martial art it is. I think it's Taekwondo, where he trains young Black men, Black kids, and connects it very much to emotional healing as well. And he's written a couple books, one of them being the first one titled Cry Like a Man. Oh. And the most recent one, Battle Cry, I think is what it's called. And he talks a lot, especially with regard to the Black experience, as men who are Black, the way they specifically hide trauma and don't want to deal with it. And I'm curious, so from a ethnic standpoint, if you will, do you see trends there? Do you tend to see more white men than Black men, or Hispanic? Or I'm just curious what that, what those trends look like from your perspective.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Mike. Unfortunately, the many different cultures don't seek counseling actually more. So if you think about Hispanic male or a Black male or a white male, what does their culture say about showing weakness, seeking help, sharing your vulnerabilities, right? Oftentimes it's you keep it in the family, you don't take it outside the family. And so what my experience has been over the years is, boy, I wish I could work with more of those cultures. But a lot of times we talk about percentages of the men that go to counseling. Now you're talking about a really small percent of minority.
Wow.
So it's unfortunate. So I think those minority populations are struggling actually more because of that one extra element of that cultural message that says you just keep it in your family or whatever.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, yeah. So Greg, you're immersed in the counseling world. It's your calling. It's your gifting. You've been doing this for a couple decades. So there's a lot of guys in our audience who have never set foot in a counselor's office and probably are reluctant's not a strong enough word. You know, they're not going there. But they may recognize that, maybe it might be helpful to me to do that because I'm struggling with something and, maybe they've got a men's group. But again, odds are, looking at the statistics, they don't. They don't have a group of men around them who are their band of brothers.
Yeah.
So why don't you help this audience who's never been in your office? What's counseling like? I mean, I think we have these images that we lie down on the couch and things that you've seen and, which is not true. Having been in counseling, I've never seen a couch. But can you help guys? Okay. So maybe they can overcome the intimidation that they may feel about seeking help. So what happens in a counseling session with you? Take us step by step. I've got an issue. I'm kind of ashamed to admit that I've got this issue, but I recognize that I need some help. So I set up an appointment with you and it's my first time in there. What happens?
Yeah. So first I'm going to say, if you take Ephesians 5 out of the Bible and you look at a man's role, right? To sacrifice as Christ died for the church and gave himself up for her and then washing his wife, in through the word. When we talk about 80% of females that attend counseling and 20% of those men that I joked earlier were being drugged by their wives or their partners, the men's role as the leader is not happening in the counseling room. The women are leading the women are leading their husbands or their partners. The women are leading in terms of suggesting books or devotionals. Mm-hmm. The women are leading. This is where we're mixed up here. If we're going to try to follow what God's intention was for the male leader, it should be a strength to enter a counseling office, not a weakness.
Right.
It should be the role of a male to lead his family, to lead his wife, to lead his children to the counseling office, not because he's in trouble from his wife. And so first, I just want to challenge guys to think about it differently. What a wonderful leadership role to lead your wife to a place of help instead of it seeing as like, this is a bad thing. This is a weakness. And I tell guys, if you come to my room and you don't do anything else but just sit in my office, you speak love to your wife.
Amen.
Because man, you're sending the message that this relationship is important and I'm going to do this, even though it's uncomfortable, even though it's difficult. I don't care what you do. And you are building trust with your wife by sitting in my office. And as far as actually once they get here, they once they experience, like, even if they're coming because addiction, once they get here and they experience grace, they experience no judgment, they experience empathy for what they're going through. Because see, when guys come into counseling because of these different types of issues, man, I'm looking behind the issues going, what kind of pain are you going through in your life and what have you experienced? And once they realize that finally they can come to a place where they've never talked about these things before with anybody.
Right.
And once they engage and get past that initial defense that someone's going to judge them, it's such a healing experience for them. And that most of them will say, I wish I would have came a long time ago.
Yep. You know, the funny thing is as you're saying that, I think about myself, and I think a lot of guys are like me. You know, I play a lot of tennis. I'm a competitive tennis player, and I look at the professional tennis players, and they don't just have one coach. They'll have six or seven coaches, each focusing on a specific aspect of their game or their nutrition or their conditioning, something like that. And nobody thinks anything bad about it. I mean, obviously you have a bunch of coaches, and in the professional world, I mean, some guys have executive coaches. They have people who help them achieve more and get better at their jobs or better in various aspects of their life. So we think coaching is great, but counseling still has this stigma. And it's just funny to me, you know, and I think it's because you approach coaching a lot of times that you want to refine something. You want to get a little better at something. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're addressing weaknesses, but you don't view them as glaring weaknesses. And I think for guys, that's something I'm ashamed of. That's a major weakness. That's a flaw. But really, the two are, I think, more similar, coaching and counseling, more similar than they are different.
Yeah, let me just say this too. You're right, Chris. And it's the atmosphere where a guy meets that type of person, whether it's a coach or a counselor, it's the setup. Mm-hmm. See, what happens with men is when you put them in an office setting and close the door, and they sit down with a strange guy and they look him in the eyes, there is a testosterone thing that happens. Mm. There's this kind of like, wait a minute, another guy is challenging me. Mm. It's not a perfect setup. Mm. But if you get a guy out somewhere, and this is where I talk about how men deal with their grief differently than women, is if you get a guy out there and you walk down the road or go down the golf course or, you know, and it's a non-direct kind of side-by-side approach,
right,
they do better. So I think if we can like look at counseling a little bit different for guys and create programs that are a little bit different so that they don't feel that tension, because this is why a lot of the programs in churches haven't lasted for men's ministries, because mm-hmm. a lot of the men's ministries were set up to be like women's ministries. Mm-hmm. Guys are not wired the same. They don't like to sit across each other and look at each other and share their feelings.
Yeah,
right.
They like to go out and do something. Like,
yeah, I agree.
Men in the Mirror Ministries years ago, they came out with a book on, like, forget the name. I guess it was Men in the Mirror, but they wanted to study guys in the church why they didn't stay engaged. And they found out that guys are different. You need to engage guys differently.
Yeah.
And the same thing in the counseling room, we have to engage guys differently. Same thing in church.
Hey guys, this is Mike Hatch. And if you are a pastor or a men's ministry leader and you're looking for a discipleship curriculum that is both affordable and accessible, I'd love to tell you more about CLC's newest curriculum line called Getting Real, a small group guide to spiritual authenticity. This study is designed for groups of 5 to 8 men meeting weekly to get real about life's victories and struggles. It's divided into 3 sessions of 12 weeks each that cover the nature of God, daily living, and the big picture. I recently started 2 Getting Real groups myself, and the $50 price tag as well as the 12-week commitment made it much easier and accessible for guys to want to jump in. This is the perfect study for guys who maybe have never been in a group before. And don't worry, this study still contains all the amazing things that make a CLC study, like fence post stories, scripture memorization, and affirmation experiences. You can find out more about this study at our website at clchq.org, or shoot me an email at mhatch@clchq.org. I'd love to talk to you about the study and how to integrate it into your own church's discipleship strategy. That's all for now, so let's get back to the interview.
Definitely. Yeah, I've found that as a men's pastor, that men are they get confused with kind of the self-help movement and their faith, and they kind of try to, you know, meld them together in some ways. And one of the things that I would tell men often is that we should be desperately dependent on God. And that's where our strength comes from, is from that, as opposed to some, you know, self-sufficient willpower that we muster up, you know, to accomplish something or just work really hard to better ourselves. And I was, Psalm 62 came into my mind, which I just wanted to read a portion of it real quick for guys. It says, I am at rest in God alone. My salvation comes from him. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I will never be shaken. First of all, that part, I love that. And I hope, you know, when a man thinks about that one verse, to me just sticks out. I will never be shaken. What man doesn't want that for themselves, right? That will never be shaken. And then verse 5-8 just says, rest in God alone, my soul, for my hope comes from him. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my stronghold. I will not be shaken. My salvation and glory depend on God, my strong rock. My refuge is in God. Trust in him at all times, you people. Pour out your hearts before him. God is our refuge. And I think of that because as a man steps into a counseling office, as you said, denies himself in that sense where he's having to kind of put away his own self-sufficiency and serve his wife and lead her in, he is taking refuge in God, right? He's saying God is our stronghold. And that's ultimately, I think, what we're called to as men is to actually demonstrate the fact that we're weak and we're desperately dependent on God. And then we lead our families to that same place of being dependent on God.
Yeah. What comes to my mind when you're talking about that, Mike, in terms of men kind of looking to God as a place to lean on or strong, I think about the number of men that grow up without fathers, you know, you know, 1/3 of children grew up without fathers in their home, and the fathers that are in the homes oftentimes are not good. Mm-hmm. And when guys come into counseling, their view of God and their ability to even attach to God is directly related to their view of their father or their view of their ability to attach to a father. And so you got guys going to church all the time, but they're not attached to God because they've got so much trauma from their father that, you know, why would I trust God? Like, why would I trust God? If I can't lean on my earthly father, it's going to be hard for me to lean on God, you know, and it's unfortunate. And that's what I'm saying. When guys start to work through that earlier trauma, maybe they can begin to kind of like trust God and connect to God versus I'm self-sufficient and I can't connect to anybody, let alone God.
Yeah. They don't see God as their refuge.
Right.
And maybe even is dangerous in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I always tell guys this, if you can't, especially when I'm working with addictions, if you can't feel your feelings, you can't feel other people's feelings, and you can't feel the Holy Spirit's. You can't feel God if you can't feel your feelings, feel other people's feelings. You see that?
Yep. Hey, that's a book, Greg, in case you're wondering. That's a book right there, man. That's amazing. Oh my gosh. You would sell a million copies to men with that. Holy cow. Anyway. That's a really
It's like, well, guys and women would come into counseling all the time and they would say, well, I've been a Christian all my life. I go to church and I worship, yeah, and I do all these things, but I do these other behaviors. I have these addictions. And like, then we finally look at, man, you're going and doing the works, but you're not feeling anything. So you can stand there all day long in church. And so it's unfortunate that, you know, the statistics are no different in the church than the world. So we have to look at that, you know. At least in my opinion, is because we've got so much trauma among those that are sitting in the congregation every week that's unaddressed or unresolved. And the church in itself doesn't know what to do with that. I mean, because then people's behavior comes out of their trauma. So then as a result of that, then Christians don't look any different.
So, you know, Mike, you mentioned earlier that I had some stats because I'm a stats guy. It's funny because I didn't like stats in college. I hated stats, but but I love stats in general. So, Greg, you were talking about how rampant this is in any setting, but in the church. And what I read, and it might have been in an article that featured you, an interview with you, but 61% of men have experienced at least one major traumatic event in their lives. And I know for some of my friends, it's divorce. I mean, you know, another thing that we minimize is the effect of divorce on men. And I've got friends that have just been through the worst. I mean, it's still going on. I mean, you know, you're 5, 6, 8, 10 years down and it hasn't gotten any better. It's gotten worse. But you know, whether it's abortion or divorce or sexual abuse, 3 in 5. So, you know, three in five of the guys listening to us right now have been through at least one major traumatic event in their lives, which I, you know, is just daunting. And you know, very few of these guys have been to counseling. Very few of these guys have a group of men in their lives, much less in their church, that can help them through this. So, Greg, you know, obviously counseling is a really good thing. And a lot of these men who've been through this at some point in their lives likely need to go into counseling. But what are some, you know, men are not in touch with their feelings. Maybe counseling seems like, well, yeah, eventually I'll go to counseling. What can they do now? You know, they recognize, you know, yeah, I have gone through something really awful in my life. Maybe it was 2 years ago. Maybe it was 30 years ago. What are some steps guys can take in the near future to get on that path to recovering from the trauma that they experienced?
Yeah, I think the first thing is just to, just like in the 12-step movement, I always say the first step in the 12 steps is to admit you have a problem, right? You know, and you know, they say, okay, I'm powerless over my addiction. I admit I have a problem. I can trust the higher power of God to restore me to a sanity kind of thing. I think the first step is just saying, okay, these things happen. You know, that's a huge step. Just to acknowledge what happened to you in your life. No, you know, like guys come to counseling all the time and they'll tell me, I've never told my wife I was sexually abused. I never told my wife I've had a previous abortion. Their heads drop down. They show there's so much shame.
Yep.
And can you imagine that you can't even tell your wife that you've been sexually abused as a child? I think the first step is just saying, you know, if it's not counseling, it's finding someone, whether it's a man that you trust, a close guy friend, a pastor, you know, someone that you can sit down and say, you know what, I want to start getting real. Because you know what, if you don't get real, I always say you can't heal.
Yeah.
Right. If you don't get real and just say, you know what, these things happen. I'm struggling with anger. I'm struggling with addiction. I'm struggling with porn addiction, whatever it is. Like, let's not just have purity groups on how to recover from porn addiction. Let's have groups of guys that get together and say, why do we have these issues? Let's just not talk about how long we've been sober. I mean, that, you know, all these recovery groups and churches are great, but if you're not talking about the other stuff that's underneath, you're going to be sitting in these recovery groups for years.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, if, like I'm saying, I guess to summarize is if they're not ready to go to a counselor, you know, just start getting real with another guy. You know, hey, let's go golfing. Let's talk about what it was like as a kid when you didn't have a dad around. Man, that's powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, that, like, hey, I was sexually abused. I haven't told anybody. Do you know how much release that comes from that?
And real quick, Greg, with regard to that, I just want to point this out because this is my experience with that. I didn't realize it was sexual abuse. Until I started reading a book, I think it was, I forget what it is. It's you'd recognize it, but I read a book and I remember they described what sexual abuse was in a way I hadn't seen before. And I thought, oh my gosh. So actually that actually was actually sexual abuse that I experienced. So some guys also might need a definition in a sense, or yeah, just to know that, yeah, that is what that was. I think some are just unaware, I guess is my point.
Yeah, one of the things that I've found with guys in sex abuse, and again, the statistics for male sex abuse is 1 in 5 on average. They think it's probably more. It's because guys just don't report it. They do minimize it because they either don't identify it as abuse, Mike, or they minimize it in a way that they're so shameful that maybe they see themselves as had some kind of responsibility or maybe there was something that was a same sex thing and they see themselves as maybe they're gay or, you know, and so there's a lot of things that kind of like hold them trapped in even kind of going there.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's kind of a very complex thing. I mean, you know, even physical abuse, you know, there's actually more physical abuse than sexual abuse in men, but I dare you to do a Google search on male physical abuse and where there are services for that. There's nothing on the internet. I've done it over and over again. Guys don't know where to go, you know, and if you do the male sex abuse, there's maybe a few organizations around the whole country that specialize in that. You do that for females, hundreds. You know, it's just sad. It's sad for the guys out there listening that are hurting, but they don't know where to go and they don't know what to do. And I just wish that, you know, we can start to look at this from a broader issue and say, you know what? There's millions and millions of guys out there that are hurting from trauma. How can we help them better? You know, instead of acting out in your symptoms, which are addictions and all these other things, let's get guys to start dealing with this hurt that's underneath. Like, let's have support groups for survivors of abuse. You know, it's not just women. You know, like, you know, we can sit all day long in recovery groups for addiction, but let's talk about the reason we got there. And I think that's the message is we got to get guys to start to look at that stuff.
Definitely. That's so well said. So well said, Greg.
Let me just say a few more things. Yeah, you'll find this interesting. Some of the scriptures I use with guys is when you talk about the heart in the Bible, oftentimes what people think, well, it's my heart and my chest, right? But when we talk about the heart, we're talking about the brain that has trauma. We're talking about the traumatized brain. So when we're talking about a changed heart, okay? So Jesus came to heal the brokenhearted and set the captives free. I'm going to paraphrase that. Jesus came to heal the traumatized brain, which is the heart, and set them free from their trauma.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus came to heal the traumatized brain. It's not the heart in your chest. You know, and when Paul says the very thing I don't want to do, I do, most likely it's a right brain problem. The knowledge of God is in the left brain. The traumatized brain is the right brain, which oftentimes drives behavior greater than your knowledge of God. Mm-hmm. Okay? And at the end of Psalm 139, and we know historically that David probably had trauma and PTSD, and he most likely...
I would imagine. he had the king trying to kill him for how many years, throwing spears at him. That's a little traumatizing.
Kidding. Yeah.
So if we look at the Bible from a psychological lens, not just a spiritual lens, we would say David's acting out of his right brain. He sees Bathsheba, right? His left brain says, I want to serve God. His right brain says, I've got a traumatized brain that needs relief. So I'm going to go do this thing like an addict would do, right? And then what happens afterwards? I can't believe I did that. Right?
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. At the end of Psalm 139, it says, search my heart, O God. Search my right brain, O God. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. I guess the message I want to say kind of in closing is there's so many millions of Christian men out there that want to be a better Christian. They want to serve their families better. They want to be an example for their children. But their right brain has trauma, and their right brain creates behaviors that don't look like a Christian. We as a church, we as a community, we as a culture need to help guys heal so that they can be those Christians. They can be the leaders of their families and not be driven by the pain that they haven't dealt with in their right brain, so that they don't have to be the David that's having an affair. They don't have to be the Paul that says, why do I keep doing what I'm doing? They can start to look at why. Because I've got trauma that I haven't dealt with. And my heart for you guys out there is, you can be that person if it's not a weakness to deal with that stuff. It's actually a strength. And the example that you set for your wife and for your kids, so that they in the future, when they have an issue, they can say, you know what? It's not a weakness to go get help. It's actually a strength.
Man. Greg, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast, man. Mm-hmm. This has been so valuable, and hopefully this will be the first of, I could see us having you back.
Yeah.
It's great to be here. It's a wonderful conversation, and just the broadness of this issue. There's so many ways to kind of discuss this issue. I'm sure there's more to follow up on that.
Yeah.
We'll have you back until you write your book, and then we'll promote your book.
That's right.
But until then.
That's right. Greg Hasek, man, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.